At issue, the song of the president, 1968. Can a president really be made by manipulating the mass media, particularly the strongest medium of them all, television? I am Denny Crimmins, associate publisher of Harper's Magazine. And with me today on At Issue is Joe McGinnis, contributor to Harper's Magazine and author of The Song of the President, 1968, which has become the nation's number one bestseller. Joe, we were talking prior to the program about how you got involved and your first sort of contacts with this sort of this new media barony that surrounds presidential candidates. Do you want to start there? Would you like to get into the heat of how you really make a candidate through television?
Well, I can start there and try to get through that background as briefly as possible. I had been doing the column in Philadelphia for about 2 years, and the Inquirer, the paper I did it for, was owned by Walter Annenberg, who, after Nixon was elected, was named ambassador to England. So it developed that my political sympathies and Mr. Annenberg's were frequently at odds, and this grew to be more of a problem as 1968 progressed, the political year, the presidential election year. And during the year, I had gotten, not intimate, but close enough to Robert Kennedy to really care when he was killed. In a column that I wrote right after that assassination from Los Angeles, in which I said America was no longer a country, but a cesspool, so enraged the publisher, Mr. Annenberg, that he felt compelled to 4 or 5 days later write an editorial in which he, I think immature was about the nicest word he used to describe me, and said that the Inquirer, as a paper, vigorously condemned my vile blasphemy of America. And I thought that over for a couple of days and just decided that I didn't want to work anymore for a man who could be so much more incensed by a column than he could by the assassination itself. So I took a week off to think things over, came up to New York and wrote a magazine story for a TV guide on Howard Cosell, the sportscaster. And while going from Cosell's home one morning to the railroad station with him, we were riding in a car with a man who was the executive vice president of Doyle Dane Birnbeck. New York Advertising Agency. And this fellow told Cosell and myself that just the day before, Doyle Dane had accepted the Hubert Humphrey account. And I told him that seemed like kind of a difficult thing to sell, even tougher than Volkswagens or Avis, with which Doyle Dane had made its name.
You're only number two with Avis,
yeah.
But with...
with Humphrey at that time, you were about number eight. However, Russell, his name was Ed Russell, he said, "Oh, you don't understand." He said, "Right now, to you, he seems like Hubert Humphrey. But by November, by God, he'll be Abraham Lincoln." And that really got me thinking. Could they really do it this way? Could a Madison Avenue agency come in, take a man, and sell him like a can of peas or an automobile? That possibility seemed intriguing enough to make me decide to leave the Inquirer and to do a book about it, basing it on the 1968 election.
You covered both candidates, not...
I covered both candidates. In fact, I got into it through Humphrey. I didn't know anyone at Nixon's headquarters. I didn't even know very many Republicans. I had to call Nixon's people blind. I found them surprisingly cooperative. As long as I agreed not to print anything before the election, they agreed to let me have complete access to their meetings, to their files, and to all the people involved in the image campaign.
From your piece on Harper's, you really got behind the scenes. I mean, the staging of how the panelists were selected, how the thing was staged, who the claques were, and how the claques were recruited.
I just about lived with these people from June through election night, literally 7 days a week, every week in that period, with the three or four people who were most responsible for the advertising of Richard Nixon, for the selling of Richard Nixon.
Would you take one of those typical programs you describe in your piece and sort of describe it to the listening audience?
Well, there were two main thrusts that the advertising took. There were, first of all, the live panel shows in which Nixon went from state to state and appeared on live television for 60 minutes, paid for time paid for just like regular advertising time is bought, and answered the questions of a panel of, quote, representative, unquote, citizens in the area. For example, in Pennsylvania, they did a show in Philadelphia where Nixon talked to 7 or 8 different people for an hour. The people were recruited by the Nixon organization, and even though their questions were legitimately new questions, it was not rehearsed. Nixon didn't know exactly what question was coming, but from having done one or two and from knowing the kind of people who were selected, who were for the most part good, loyal Republicans with an occasional House Negro thrown in, or a House Liberal who they knew wouldn't be too offensive or too penetrating. It was really a setup. It gave the appearance of being live. It gave the appearance of Nixon taking risks without actually taking any at all. Well, this was one, and to do this is one half of the thing. The other half was a series of 60-second spot commercials, which were produced by a man named Eugene Jones, who's a filmmaker, a very, very good filmmaker, too. Here, Nixon's words, mostly the same old tired words of the acceptance speech, would be played in accompaniment to a series of still photographs that were being flashed in rapid succession across the screen, so that you might, in 60 seconds, get 40 or 50 different colored photographs.
Counterpoint to the words.
Counterpoint to the words, so that the same tired words could, through this very sophisticated use of a multimedia technique, sink in quite deeply into a person's, not just to his consciousness, but to his subconsciousness.
Well, I remember very clearly the one you describe in your piece is that that panning and panning back from a helmet in Vietnam. It's
right.
Love on the front of the helmet, which is, I think, was the concluding shot of his...
This was the concluding shot. Nixon, of course, had been saying really not too much about Vietnam. They took a few of the old tape recordings and spliced them together, where Nixon was saying that we've got to, you know, new leadership will bring an end to this war, an honorable end to the war in Vietnam, avoid the mistakes of the past 4 years. While he was saying this, however, a series of dramatic pictures would be flashed across the screen, and the last one was of a completely tired and exhausted and beaten-down soldier leaning against a bunker in Vietnam with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, wearing a helmet on which the word love was inscribed, and slowly the camera came in tighter and tighter and tighter until the final shot was just a forehead and helmet, an eye close-up, which contained the word love in the big letters. And interestingly enough, there's a little postscript to that. This was this particular spot and this particular use of the word love in a soldier's helmet so enraged Midwestern congressmen by, in their eyes, it equated soldiers with hippies. You know, love to them was a dirty word. In 1968, to a lot of Republicans, love was a dirty word. It was associated with hippies and anti-establishment demonstrations. And a number of congressmen from the Midwest called Nixon's advertising people and said, this just won't do. This is going to hurt him out here. Their kind of soldiers, the Midwestern kind of soldiers, not the kind who wears love on his helmet. He wears kill or, you know, God bless America, but certainly not love. So under pressure of this sort, that particular photograph was removed from later versions of that 60-second commercial. Right.
Again, let's go back to this particular image of Nixon. You know, from Hubert Horatio Humphrey to Abe Lincoln is one transition. But the lighting from the 5 o'clock shadow of Nixon we knew in the Nixon Kennedy debates of his past trip to the same race.
There was none of that here. Although actually things like that, those physical problems are about the easiest to overcome. Those are just really minor technical points which any good makeup man can overcome. The concept of creating a whole new Nixon, or first of all, of just destroying the old Nixon, because this was really what their job was with Nixon. There was a stereotype firmly implanted in the minds of most Americans of Richard Nixon, and it was not a stereotype which would cause them to vote for him for president. So that the first job that Nixon's advertising people had was to erase this old image, and they set about taking great pains as early as the fall of 1966 to slowly and carefully, with very subtle strokes, erase this old image.
How? By getting him around from the other side of the desk? By seeing him leaving him unprotected in front of the television cameras?
That's a good example. By making him appear... The best way that it was put by one of Nixon's staff people, that we have to make it seem that in addition to all his other attributes, Richard Nixon really considers communicating with the people of America to be one of the great joys in life. And if there's anything that's true of Richard Nixon, of course, is that he does not consider communicating with the people of America a great joy in life. You know, he much prefers the isolation of the White House. This is why he's so happy as president, is that he is legitimately cut off from the people. He doesn't have to get out there and mix it up with a man in the street whose instincts he shares, but whose company he doesn't really relish. So they had to make him appear warmer, more human. They had to give him a sense of humor. And the sense of humor was acquired through high-paid gag writers. One of the early notations made by Nixon's creative director of advertising was that he needs humor, but here we have to be very careful because Romney's cornball attempts have hurt him more than helped him. And his precise phrase, in fact, which is included in the piece, is if we're going to be witty, let a pro write the words.
Mm-hmm.
And this
and
was a keynote.
It couldn't
of the
be sort of the press conference Kennedy style of wit.
No, it couldn't
be. Something counterpoint to that even.
Right.
I know, so you also in here, you talk about the rest of the family in the act, also very sort of, I forget what you called them, the Nixon chorus or the...
The Glee Club.
The Glee Club, that's
one of the assistants called them. This was another part of the attempt to humanize him. Don't show him only with a briefcase in his hand. Occasionally try to present him in warm human situations with his arm around his wife or kissing his daughter on the cheek. It wasn't the kind of thing that was natural to him, but to a certain extent, he agreed to consciously try to act as if he were a little more in love, simply to make himself appear more as a human being.
You seem to indicate also that there's some work done on Mrs. Nixon and sort of a softening of her image vis-a-vis the female voter.
There was an attempt at this, but she was quite difficult to work with, and the final compromise that was made, I think, was just keeping her out of the picture as much as possible. She would appear for each panel show, and there would be an introduction of her and whichever daughter happened to be with her at the time in the beginning, but there would, except for the telethon and the last night of the campaign, there would be no real direct contact with her during these shows. She was there, she was a fixture, but in the end, she became little more than an ornament.
This is kind of a counterpoint to her predecessor.
It was
omnipresent in almost everything.
Sure.
The thing that in reading your piece, when you really start to think about it, is the measure and the power of the manipulation of this particular medium.
Right. These guys are just too good for us. There is no defense against it because we just don't know at the time what's being done. There are probably very few people in America who were not involved who got to see it the way I did. And certainly if you're just home as a television viewer seeing this stuff come to you in its final form every night, you really don't have a defense. There's no way you can guard against it.
Do you think there ought to be any kind of legislation or any sort of code of ethics or some way of controlling this?
Well, there already is some legislation involving the use to which a president or the executive department of the federal government can put television. For example, a president is not allowed to use any visual aids when he's making a speech on television to the country. All he can do is stand there and speak. He can't use charts and slides and graphs.
Or cut away to the photographs we talked about earlier.
Or if he's talking about poverty, he can't come up with a little film sequence of showing poor people. Now, perhaps this kind of a thing is going to have to be extended to advertising in a campaign for the presidency, because the way it went in 1968, really, it was not a battle between the two men. It was a battle between the image makers on either side.
The opposing image makers were fighting it out with scissors and film and lighting techniques.
Right, and the candidates themselves really were little more than pawns on the board.
Well, this sort of, is this now being applied to local candidates? Has everybody kind of learned a lesson from the selling of a president?
Well, it has been, and in fact, I think to some extent Nixon learned a lesson from the selling of some local candidates. I mean, John Lindsay was not exactly naive in this area in his first campaign. Governor Rockefeller, nor Ronald Reagan, of course, nor Percy, nor almost any young and personable candidate. The interesting thing about this is that Nixon was neither young nor personable. And this demonstrated that these same techniques can work not with only with a man.
You don't have to be a George Murphy or a Reagan or a television star.
You don't have to have the charisma.
Or,
they can give it to you no matter who you are.
Thank you, Joe McGinnis.
Thank you, Denny.
We've taken a close look at how television can sell a presidency. I am Denny Crimmins, associate publisher of Harper's Magazine, and this has been At Issue.